I'm John Coates, University of Cambridge. I'm working in the border country of neuroscience, physiology, and finance. My background is that I used to run a trading desk on Wall Street and made the switch into physiology and neuroscience when I began to suspect that the physiology of traders was contributing to financial market instability. So it's... the connection with my research and what you're doing here is sort of, I think that's a different, that's a jump someone else is going to have to make. I'll talk about my research, and if you can make the connection, then please do. I suppose one of the reasons there is a connection is that the world I come from, I come from two worlds. There's the economics world, which thinks that we're in a world populated by rational economic agents. Now, that's an old paradigm. I don't want to set up a straw man here, because since that paradigm dominated, there's been the invention of behavioral economics and finance, which argues somewhat along the lines of that, no, we're not this rational computer we used to think we are. We have all these sort of quirks to the way we think, and sometimes they don't square with the axioms of rational choice theory. Nonetheless, it's a branch of psychology. Neuroeconomics is bringing in more of the brain. But what they all three paradigms share is that they focus on economics and economic choice as a cognitive issue. Now, obviously, when you go to make choice, it's going to be cognitive. But what I think is missing from that is an appreciation for how the physiology, how our body affects the way we make decisions, particularly when we go to take risk. Risk is a very visceral experience. And the reason it's important to start looking at physiology is that largely in the policy world, we're still living in the world of classical economics, where the assumption is we are dealing with an economy of rational economic agents. And if you are dealing with an economy like that, then the way you cure its problems is through price signals. If people are rational, then they will respond to price signals. And the most important price signal they've got in policy is the interest rate. So if you've got a stock market bubble, which, of course, according to that paradigm, shouldn't exist, but that's another thing. If you've got a bubble, then perhaps you can slow it down by raising the price of money. And if you've got a crash, stock market crash, you can solve that problem by lowering the price of money. And if people are rational, then they will respond to the lower or the higher price of money. But, of course, it doesn't work. I mean, central banks have had a really checkered experience in either stopping a bubble with higher interest rates, because, for example, take the dot-com bubble or the Roaring Twenties. People thought they were buying into the future. They thought that the companies they were buying, you know, eventually would be worth, you know, 100 times what they were when they bought them. Now, against those expectations, you raise interest rates from 5% to 6%. 6% to 7% has no effect, absolutely none. I mean, short of raising them like 10 points, the interest rates really can have a hard time stopping a bubble. And in a crash, I mean, in the middle of the credit crisis, we dropped interest rates to zero, and it had no effect. There was irrational risk aversion within the financial community, and they just were not touching any risky asset, no matter what the price, no matter how cheap they got and how free the money was, they weren't touching it. And it wasn't because risk management told them don't buy anything. It was because even like hedge funds and people managing their own money, they weren't buying it. So this wasn't like an order coming down from risk management. So we've got a policy world that's still largely based on classical economics. Now, the problem with it is, or the problem I began to suspect with that paradigm, is that it's built without any experimental evidence, without any data at all, really. And by that I mean that there's no field work. Because in a true biological science, there's a spectrum of studies. So animal behavior, for example, you start out with field work. You spend maybe, if you're an academic, you maybe spend your summers in Kenya observing baboons. You see anomalies in their behavior you don't understand. During the winter, you go back to the lab and you try and figure out what is causing that behavior. And you have this continuum of studies from the field work that spots the anomalies according to current theory and going right through to behavioral experiments in the lab to maybe experiments with pharmacology, maybe right down to the molecular level, and you get this spectrum of studies that are each contributing to each other. But that doesn't exist in economics because there's no field work being done in finance. And I'll give you an example of why that's so serious, because when I was running this trading desk on Wall Street, I mean, I personally felt these surges of euphoria and pessimism that were absolutely uncontrollable. And it wasn't because the information had changed in such a way that I had a rational assessment that now stocks offered, you know, infinite possibilities. And it wasn't me being game theoretic. Okay, everyone else thinks it's a bubble, so I'll jump on and try and get out before everyone else. That wasn't what's going on at all. Those are theories, and those theories have to be tested against the data. The most important piece of data is that that's not what it feels like to be a trader. What it feels like to be a trader is that you've got this narcotic high that causes you to take absolutely moronic risks in absolutely huge size in ever increasingly worse risk-reward trade-offs. That's a really important datum, but it's a datum that's never been incorporated within all the subjects of studying financial market instability, you know, economics, finance, game theory, you know, the work on chaos coming out of physics or whatever. No one had ever actually looked at the physiology of traders, looked at them from a medical point of view. Were these people suffering from some kind of pathology? Was their physiology actually trading? And was that physiology shifting risk preferences systematically across the business cycle so that it was exaggerating these cycles? Does something happen to the bodies of risk takers during a bull market that causes the bull market to morph into a bubble? We don't think, the group I work with at Cambridge, we don't think that the physiology is creating the bull market. That's coming from advances in technology or whatever, like the dot-com bubble that was advances in technology. But something changes a bull market into a bubble. And we think, in the case of our research, that the hormones are having a really big role to play in shifting risk preferences. We were looking in particular at testosterone. It's the way it builds up in the bodies of traders during a bull market, and that shifts their risk preferences to the point that the market becomes a bubble. And during the crash, we were looking at stress hormones because we think those build up in the traders during a crash, and that makes them become irrationally risk-averse. So I'll wind up by saying that if this hypothesis is correct, that the physiology of traders is destabilizing the financial market, and the three or four studies we've done to date has provided fantastic data, far stronger than we were ever suspecting, then we live in a really, really different world from the one that economics is still using to inform policy. Because price signals can no longer be seen as being the tool with which you combat financial market instability. You have to start thinking about something else. And if it's true that these hormones are having the effect, then you have to start thinking about hormone diversity in the financial world. And the way you get that is by having a greater diversity on the trading floors in age and sex, because they all have different endocrine profiles. And if these endocrine profiles are affecting risk preferences, then you have to start considering really non-traditional policies like increasing the number of women in the banks, increasing the, you know, making sure that guys don't get laid off when they hit the age of 40. Because what we've got is a financial community that's all large, it's 98% young males. Now there may be, I think what happens is that when you get one slice of the population isolated, you tend to get extreme behavior. And there may be times when you want that. Maybe in times of war you want that. You want all these guys to coalesce together and go wilding. But when you're allocating the capital society, I don't think you want that. And so I think you want the whole village there. There's an enormous amount of interest in the media, in the banks, and in the central banks to support this policy of increasing particularly the number of women in the banks. I think they should also be looking at the number of older men, but they don't know how to do it. And it's really important now because, for example, the U.S. Department of Labor released statistics showing the participation of women in the financial world. And over the past 10 years, the participation of women in the workforce has gone up like something like 10%. In the financial world, it's actually dropped about 10%. And those numbers are both on a relative and absolute numbers. So there's all this lip service being paid to the policy, and it's not being put into practice. Now, in defense of the banks, I think they would like to, put this policy in effect. They just don't know how to do it. And I think to do it, you have to start thinking about how to redesign the jobs within the banking system so that they're jobs that, A, women are, that's tailored to women's cognitive strengths and ones that they actually want to do. Because right now, women just don't want to be traders.
Can I ask you a practical question?
Yep.
I mean, implementing it can be easy. I'll have to put a rule. The question is, let's say there's a king,
No. But in this case, it wouldn't work.
You have to pull. But see, the thing is that how does the consumer, the people choose that different variety? If the young male is the one who's somehow producing, during the bull market, the greatest reward, it's going to be, they have a selective advantage. It's just like, survival of the fittest. So some, like an investor would want that young male and doesn't want the 60-year-old.
Why? Because in the fifth,
because of the returns. Because that's the thing, because that testosterone is...
Okay.
You have to think about it at the global, at the consumer level as well, not just having a floor with 20 women, 25 years old, and 20, 60 years old.
I think the people who would support that policy, or the people who should be supporting it, is the board of a bank, the people who represent the shareholders, because what you're getting is a compensation scheme that rewards variance. Imagine two traders. There's one trader who makes $10 million a year for 5 years, and he gets paid 10%. So he pockets $1 million bonus each year. At the end of 5 years, he's made $50 million for the bank, and he's pocketed $5 million. There's another trader who makes $100 million a year, and they don't want that guy to go to a hedge fund, so they pay him 20%. He pockets $20 million a year in a bonus. And these numbers are about right. He does that for 4 years. In the fifth year, he loses $500 million. And he doesn't get paid a bonus. At the end of 5 years, the bank has lost $100 million and the trader has pocketed $80 million. Now, which of those traders would you rather be? Because everybody on Wall Street has figured out that what you want to do is maximize the variance of your P&L, your profitability. You want to make $100 million 1 year, lose it the next, and as long as you're in the big numbers, you lose $100 million, you get fired, someone else is going to hire you. You're a hitter. If you're going to lose money on Wall Street, lose big, because you'll always find another job. So, I've seen everyone on Wall Street slowly figure that out. I mean, when I started on Wall Street, I thought the payoff was to be prudent, but it's not. So, if you're asking who's interested in this policy, I would expect the boards to be. What is just baffling to me is this massive failure of corporate governance that took place before, during, and after the credit crisis, in that they're not actually changing the compensation schemes at all to address...
Because probably there are forces, there are incentives there to maintain that scheme.
Well, sure, as long as the board...
Let's come back to this. Yes. So we can get everybody else...
Okay. But at any rate, I'll finish by saying that if we've got this biology taking place, markets are influenced by nature and nurture. We've got this biology taking place, and our data supports the idea that it's helping to destabilize the markets, then what you need are management and compensation schemes that lean against the biology. And you can do that. But right now, we've got the worst of both worlds. We've got the biology that tends towards instability and management and compensation schemes that exaggerate it. But what that's got to do with the food industry?
I will tell you what it has to do with the food industry.
Okay.
The alignment of incentive is one, but that's not the one that motivated me having you here this morning. Is that you said that the risk is very visceral. You lose X million and you feel it. Antoine is saying you see the fat and you feel excited. In the domains of health, we don't think of risk. We haven't talked theoretically about risk because you don't feel the urge of saying, gee, I'll get cancer in 20 years. Mm-hmm. So the thinking of both reward and risk as they are experiences at a given point in time, how they evolve over time, there is a whole lot. And so far, we have just primarily on the reward side of the food. And I... We need to get serious about that, because it's could you calm down your experience of risk to the high trade, to the high high risk on the market, or could we intensify the immediate perception of risk on the health side? But that's part of the discussion.
Let me say something, because this stuff has been tried before in the medical arena. To quit smoking, they tried people where actually they show them people with cancer, and plastic, get as visceral as it can be. And if you think people will get scared and stop smoking, in those particular studies, the opposite happened. People went and started smoking even more. Sometimes, but that's an important point. But sometimes not making everything visceral necessarily works.
We'll come back to it. I know with Laurette now, I understand why she didn't want to introduce this session, because she wants to keep going in between. She wants to give me the hard job.
Yeah, exactly.